we don't know so much in the case of the Somalian cavefish that we studied, because obviously it's very, very difficult now to actually get into the country and see where they are, where they were originally collected. But we do know a certain amount from the scientists who originally collected these animals. And also there are various other studies in other parts of the world looking at other types of cavefish, which tell us that indeed the quality and the quantity of food in these cave environments is very poor. And for example, there are caves in Mexico where certain species of cavefish live, where the primary source of food is actually bat droppings. So bats roost in these caves, and every day they fly in and out from the cave to feed. And when the bats come back into the cave, they produce lots of droppings which falls into the water, and the cavefish are eating what is left from these droppings. Obviously there are no green plants in the water, and so there are very, very peculiar sources of nutrients, such as the bat droppings, that these fish will be relying upon. What we don't know about is, obviously, in the case of this animal, is where their food will be originally coming.
So this is something you really don't know, what the cavefish is eating if you don't give them food.
In their wild, in their natural habitat, we do not know. We can speculate. There are other animals that live in the water with them. Then we know that there are crustacean, shrimps and prawns, these kind of animals which live in these cave environments. And they share with the cavefish very strange adaptations. They are completely without eyes. They are completely white. They have no pigment. And we assume that the larger cavefish are able to eat these types of crustacea. So that's one potential source of food, but obviously there may be others, we just don't know.
If in Mexico these fish are known to eat the bat droppings,
Yes.
there is an indirect link to light because the bats are influenced by the day-night
It's a very
cycle.
interesting situation indeed. The bats are influenced by the day-night cycle. They have normal clocks, which tells them when they need to wake up and fly out of the cave to feed at night. And obviously, they come back to the cave before the light comes in the morning. So indeed, there is a very interesting situation where a clock in one animal and its link with the outside world is indirectly affecting the cave fish in this population. The prediction of the Somalian cavefish is that the isolation is more complete and that they live beneath a desert. And it's questionable whether indeed there would be bats in these caves that they live in. So it's very difficult to evaluate precisely whether they may have an indirect link with the outside world.
How have they been discovered, the Somalian cavefish?
So they were collected in the 1970s by Italian scientists. So Somalia used to be a territory that was very closely linked with Italy. And there were many expeditions made by Italian scientists who collected various species of animals, including different species of fish. And a group of scientists from Florence actually went and collected these cavefish and brought them back to Florence and actually kept them in the museum there, as well as documenting what they found and where they found them. And there were two or three, I think, expeditions subsequently which again collected more specimens. And these are all kept now were kept in Florence. And very recently, these animals have been moved to Ferrara, where we now have them. And what is actually another interesting property of these animals, they're extremely long-lived. And some of the fish that were collected as adults in Somalia in the early 1970s are still alive and still breeding to date. And this is one of their remarkable properties. This is their longevity. And predictions are that some of these animals can live 50, 60 years without any problem. And it's really remarkable. And it's something particular for cave species. We've no idea why, but this seems to be a recurrent property of these animals that come from these cave environments.
So the aging process is very slow.
Correct. The aging process is very slow, but remarkably their very early development, so their embryonic development, is very fast. Much faster than, for example, a zebrafish. And we know in this case, for this particular Somalian cavefish, that from the time that the egg is first fertilized to the time that the little larva hatches out of the egg and starts swimming takes approximately 22 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly there is a big advantage for these fish to be mobile and escape from their egg, where presumably they are more risk of predation. And it could be that some of these crustacean that I mentioned are actually looking for eggs, fish eggs, and eating them. So obviously, if you're able to get out of your egg as fast as possible, this helps a lot. So it's a very strange situation: very rapid early development, and then a very slow aging process. And there are also implications that the aging process is linked with a very low metabolic rate. So these fish have a very low oxygen consumption, and they can survive long periods without food. So you can, in captivity, normally we feed them one time per week. But if you force them and you deprive them of food, you can keep them for 2 to 3, 4 weeks without any food at all, and they are absolutely fine. The prediction is that their ability to tolerate long time without food is linked with them not being able to find food regularly in their cave environment. So it's an adaptation that they have to survive this very extreme situation that they've evolved in.
If we read about this body clock around 47 hours, it's approximately twice as long as a normal body clock.
Correct.
Do you have any explanation why it's twice as much? Why not three times or four times? Or
well, indeed,
no relation at all?
Sure. I mean, this is indeed a very basic and very important, obvious question. Why have such a long free-running clock? There are two possible explanations for this. One of them is that this clock is basically in the process of being completely lost. Like their eyes, these animals don't have eyes, so maybe they don't have clocks. Why should they need a clock in a relatively constant, completely dark environment where one questions whether there is any impact of the day-night cycle? Maybe they just don't need to keep a clock. Maybe
so your guess is 1 million years in the future they won't have a clock.
Maybe they would not have a clock. That's one prediction, one speculation, right? Another way to look at this is to say that indeed, with a clock that measures time with a 47-hour period, maybe there is something in their environment which gives that they have an advantage with this type of clock. It's known that, I mean, clocks are quite complicated. One parameter that they have is their period length, so they have how long it takes to complete one clock cycle. But another very important property of clocks is how they are regulated by external signals, like feeding time, or like temperature, or like light normally. Sometimes these different parameters are linked together. And for example, it could be that a 47-hour clock is just more flexible than a 24-hour clock in terms of the types, the frequency of food that it might encounter. And in fact, one of the experiments we're currently testing is to see how these animals adapt to food arriving at different frequencies. So we have animals where we provide food every 60 hours, for example, or where we provide them every 24 hours. And the indications we have is that these animals are very flexible. They can adapt to many different frequencies of food that might come.
So 47 hours is the their natural.
That's their natural clock. If you put them in an artificial situation,
you can fasten it by giving them food every 24 hours. They begin every 24 hours to be active food searching.
Exactly. And they will
slow down to 60 hours.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's the other possible reason why they may need such an abnormal clock. And which of the two possibilities is the reality? We still do not know. This is one of the issues that we are currently putting
and
a lot of effort
is
in.
Their body clock much more flexible than the body clock of organisms who are living in the day night?
That's the indication indeed, yes, that they have a greater flexibility, yes.
Mm-hmm. So with zebrafish who are experiencing mm-hmm. day and night, mm-hmm. you wouldn't be able to slow down their clock as much.
There is a limit for zebrafish and other diurnal animals. Mm-hmm. Normally, for example, you could give them a regular environmental signal that might be as short as 20 hours in frequency. And you might be able to increase it up to maybe 30 hours, but that's really the limit when you still would have a normal clock activity. If you go beyond those time frames, then the system somehow breaks down. It gets quite complicated, the results that you see, and this is not what we see with the cavefish.
So the range of the cavefish
maybe more,
maybe
yeah.
more, but you don't know the limits. The shortest period.
No,
and
that's
longest.
Exactly what we are doing
mm-hmm.
at the moment to try to mm-hmm. understand this. Yeah, and obviously another major issue that we are also looking into is the molecular origin of this very strange clock.
Mm-hmm. This is the part is difficult to understand for non-biologists.
Yep. Right.
You are examining the genetic functioning.
Correct.
And which genes are responsible for the photoreceptors and which genes are responsible for the other?
Absolutely. So, indeed.
Yeah.
So this paper really focuses on the photoreceptors.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, we are also putting a lot of attention on genes that are known to be involved in clocks. And this is a very well-studied arena since a lot of work in Drosophila, in mice, in various other species, model species.
Even in fungi, I've read.
Even in fungi, yeah. in bacteria, in plants. It's a very well-studied system. And as a result of all this information, we know or we can predict which genes are what we call clock genes. So these are the components, the real core clock components, the cogs, if you want, of the clock. What we have therefore been doing is looking at the counterparts of these clock genes in the cavefish to try to find if any of them carry mutations, obvious changes that could predict that they are no longer functioning normally and could explain this very long clock period that these cavefish have. And this is, again, another of our ongoing projects that we're still not arrived at completion of.
Mm-hmm.
There are three or four groups of what we call clock genes, but then there are many genes that are regulating these clock genes, which are not only dedicated to clock activity, mm-hmm. and therefore it's quite a big job to evaluate all the candidate genes that might be involved in this. And obviously one step that we are planning which would help this whole process is to actually sequence the genome of this particular cavefish, compare it with the genome that is already sequenced for zebrafish, and by comparing the two, hopefully we will get even more insight into the molecular changes that have occurred during the evolution of the cavefish, which has led to this very strange...
Are these two fish otherwise from the same family?
Cavefish, this particular Somalian cavefish and zebrafish indeed belong to the same family, the Cyprinid
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually one of the reasons why we chose this particular animal. was the similarity with zebrafish, and the possibility that we could use lots of the information and tools that we already had from studying zebrafish, we could use it directly to look at this particular animal.
Mm-hmm.
So this was,
if I remember rightly, you also inserted a specific gene in zebrafish, a gene from cavefish.
That's right. So this was related to the photoreceptor studies.
Yeah.
So by this same kind of approach, comparing the gene or genes from a cavefish with genes from a zebrafish, we saw that there were mutations in two opsin genes in cavefish,
mm-hmm.
which were normal in the zebrafish counterpart. And so one of the simple-minded ideas we had was, well, what if we took the zebrafish gene and put it back into a cavefish? Could we rescue the cavefish cell's ability to respond to light? And in fact, this is what we did. We did these experiments with cell cultures that we established from cavefish and from zebrafish. And we put into these cells biosensors for light response. And as soon as we put the zebrafish photoreceptor opsin, normal opsin, into the cavefish cell, the biosensor indicated that indeed we had restored light sensing to these cells. So after 3 million years in complete darkness, finally we engineered these cavefish cells to be able to respond to light.
And how do cells respond to light? It is a cell culture, it's not an organism. How do you see whether they are responding?
We need to look at the level of genes. So basically we know in animals and in cells similarly that when you shine light on them, you have a response at the level of the expression of certain genes.
Mm-hmm.
And
you can measure their activity, because when they are active they produce some proteins. And
well, we play a few more tricks. So we create, as I said, a kind of a biosensor
mm-hmm.
line, which means that we take the region of DNA which normally regulates these genes, and we couple it to an artificial gene, which is, we use luciferase. So this is something that comes from fireflies, right? So this is what makes fireflies glow
mm-hmm.
at night. It's an enzyme, and when you provide this enzyme with its substrate, which is called luciferin, it glows, it emits light.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, by measuring the amount of light that the cell produces, you have a direct measure of the activity of your regulatory DNA sequence that you've put in, which is a light responsive DNA sequence. So in this way, you can basically measure the activity of the cell's response to light completely without invading the cell or measuring chemically measuring anything. It's purely based on detecting the light that the
mm-hmm.
luciferase produces. And this is actually a very common trick that circadian biologists like myself use to study the clock as well. You can measure the clock activity by linking DNA sequences to luciferase, and these DNA sequences might be clock regulated sequences. And in this way, you can basically, just by measuring this glow, this bioluminescence, you can measure how the clock itself is ticking. So it's a very powerful, relatively simple approach that gives you a really a lot of insight into the regulation in a living cell or a living animal.
Mm-hmm. Why do you study the circadian clocks of fish and not from mammals?
Okay, well, there are various reasons. So one is that fish provide us with aspects of biology that the classical mammalian systems like mouse do not provide us. One of them is that fish have this very strange property that their tissues and cells directly respond to light. And this is something that is not the case in a mouse or in a human, for example. our clocks are totally reliant upon our eyes and our retinas.
If not, not the skin.
No, no.
Even if we create vitamin D or...
No, our clocks, our internal circadian clock is totally reliant upon our eyes and our retina.
I've noted one question I will put you, blind people.
Well, indeed, there are various types of blindness. There are people who have the inability to see things. However, they still have an optic nerve, which is connected to their brain. And these people, most cases of blindness, actually, their clocks are regulated normally by light. It's just that they can't perceive images. Okay. However, there are situations where, for various reasons, the eyes have been surgically removed, or the nerves which link the eye with the brain has been damaged in a way that it is no longer able to function. These people have not anymore the ability to regulate their clocks by light. It's a very impressive result, very depressing result for the patients, but basically their clocks progressively drift out of synchrony with the environment. And it's changing throughout the year. At some points, they're lucky and their clock is completely synchronized with the day-night cycle. But at other times of year, they find that their clocks are completely the opposite in terms of synchrony. They're asynchronous with the environment. As a result, if these people are trying to do to work, they find that they're feeling that during the daytime, when they should work, they feel like it's the middle of the night and it's a big problem. And what people have been doing to try to help these kind of people is to use this hormone melatonin, which you probably hear a lot about, to actually artificially synchronize their clock. So these people need to take melatonin tablets at a particular time of day every day, and this substitutes for the lack of their eyes. So this is a very clear demonstration that for a mammal and for a human being, the retina is fundamental for the light to regulate their clocks.
I did not know. I thought that the skin also gives information about
it. There have been various controversial claims that shining light behind people's knees has some effect on their clocks, but this has never been confirmed. And the strong indicators for various types of study are that in mammals and particularly in humans, there is no other source of input to the clock.
But the fish and other tissues, they are also sensitive.
In the fish, all the tissues are sensitive. So you can, for example, take the heart of an adult zebrafish, put it into a culture dish and shine light on it there, and you can regulate the clock in this tissue. You can do it with cell lines, you can do it with most of the tissues, you can do it with the skin. Pretty much the fish is like a plant, it's completely light sensitive. And this is one very important justification for studying fish. Another issue with fish is that they are an extremely diverse group of animals. There are maybe 30, 40,000 species of teleost fish in the world, living in very, very diverse environments. If you want to study how clocks are adapted to their environment, the fish is actually a remarkably good model to study this, because you have the possibility, like we have done here with a cavefish, to look under an extreme situation of lighting condition and find how the fish clock has adapted to these conditions. And this is really can teach you a lot, not only about evolution, but also it can, and as we've done here, it can teach you about the basic mechanisms themselves. I mean, clocks are evolved in animals to enable them to adapt to their environments optimally. They are therefore intended to be flexible, because animals live in very different environments. And so we can really learn a lot about the flexibility of clocks by studying diverse groups of animals such as fish. And then, I mean, a third reason for studying fish, we do have great possibilities with species such as the zebrafish. Here we have a genetic model organism. We have a complete genome sequence. We have really amazing possibilities to study these animals very early in their development. The whole process of embryogenesis is very accessible in species like the zebrafish. And also they are relatively transparent. So if you want to look at processes, molecular processes, at the whole animal level without needing to cut up anything or break down anything, you could do it remarkably well with these kind of fish.
You see their process of digestion and you see through
yes,
them.
you can see their brain function, you can see lots of their heart activity. It's a transparent, the younger stages are relatively transparent, so you can see this without any problem. So I personally like the best strategy, I think, is to use the various aspects of the fish provide us. So comparing species like the zebrafish, where you have lots of tools to study, with other species of fish, which are not so different at the molecular level, you can learn a lot about various biological processes. I mean, zebrafish also have this amazing capacity to regenerate their tissues, and which is another fit general fish property. So you can damage
the the axolotl.
You cut
one limb and it grows back.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a similar situation with zebrafish and fish generally. You can damage the central nervous system. For example, you can cut through the spinal cord, which in the case of a human is a permanent situation. You cannot repair that kind of damage. These animals have the capacity to regenerate their nervous system. They have the capacity to regenerate damage to the heart. And so there's a lot of biomedical interest of fish in terms of trying to understand what are these mechanisms and how can we learn from them to maybe, you know, for drug discovery situations. So I think fish are a really exciting group of animals to study and for what we are interested in the clock, but more generally.
Mm-hmm. When they can regenerate damage done to their tissues, are they long-lived, the zebrafish, as well?
No.
So they die, but from which causes do they die?
There are various problems that they will ultimately
face. They get
old? They do age. And normally a zebrafish, if it lives 3 or 4 years, it's going pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So the cave fish, it has approximately the double of the clock, but he does not live the double of the years, but much, much longer.
Absolutely.
20 times as much.
Absolutely.
And does not get cancer, no degeneration?
For the cavefish, we don't know. And actually, that's a very good point. How do certain pathologies develop in these kind of animals? We don't know. And I think there is a lot to learn and many adaptations that we still don't know about. Which will somehow be linked with this extreme environment that they live in.
But you don't know much also about their behavior in nature. You can observe them in captivity. But,
Correct. These Somalian fish, we know very little. There are other species, as I mentioned before, there are Mexican species, which are much better studied than our fish, our Somalian fish. And indeed, there have been speculation that the loss of eyes and the increase in sensitivity of these other senses may well be linked together in some way.
Did you read recently there was a Nature small story about the naked mole rat?
Yes.
And of course, this is a mammal. It's a different organism and it lives in tribes or herds. So very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Does not get cancer. Does age slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And does not have, I think they have a rest of visual, but
correct.
They don't use it much.
Correct.
And they are insensitive, nearly insensitive to different sorts of pain.
Right.
Very interesting organisms
right.
as well.
Right, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, this is one of the animals that definitely we think about when we think about life in constant darkness. I think it's a question of degrees in terms of how isolated the animals are in this environment. The question is whether these mammals, that these subterranean mammals, are completely isolated from the day-night cycle or not. Our fish in Somalia is definitely an extreme case of isolation. It lives beneath a desert, and there are no layers of water on the surface where it could communicate. So the prediction we have is that the more isolated the animal is, the more extreme are the adaptations that it will show. And indeed, the question relates to, you know, whether these animals are more or less prone to cancer. It's why I'm really interested to look in these animals, because in principle they are even more extreme than these mole rats that people are studying. And I think for that reason, you know, potentially there is a lot to study, a lot to learn. It's actually another species that is a very interesting from this perspective are reindeer. So reindeer that live above the Arctic Circle. And these animals are very strange because of the extreme lighting conditions that they normally experience. So
they don't have a day-night, or
exactly,
very strange day-night.
Exactly. So they have, you know, in the summer, they will have pretty much constant light.
Mm-hmm.
The sun never completely goes away. And in the winter, of course, the other extreme, they essentially have pretty much constant dark conditions for periods of the year. And it's interesting, people looked at clocks in these animals, and there was a paper in Current Biology a couple of years ago which documented this. What they seem to see is a big reduction in the circadian clock activity in these animals. And the prediction is that this is because the clock does not provide them with any advantage living in these extreme conditions. So, for example, in the summer, when the light is there constantly, these animals are basically active throughout the day-night cycle with short periods of resting, but they are feeding all the time. And it's considered that this is more advantageous for the animal than if the animal had a normal clock and it was sleeping at times when there was still light there, and it could still, in principle, be out there eating. So it's an interesting parallel with what we see with the cavefish, and also what you mentioned with the mole rats.
Mm-hmm. And if reindeer, as advanced mammals, can do that, mm-hmm. how about traditional humans living there?
Well, how long have humans been living there? This is the issue.
Yeah, only 10,000 years,
sure.
Maybe. Yeah, several thousand years,
yeah.
But not very long. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, I mean, the only clock-related information that we have from these populations that live in these areas is there are quite often these seasonal affective disorders where basically you get cases of depression, which are linked with these very extreme lighting conditions. And I think the suicide rate is higher during the polar winter conditions. And it's clearly a very difficult environment to live in for a human being. And indeed, one speculates whether if man is still alive, still around in a couple of million years, whether indeed we might end up in a similar situation where, you know, maybe Eskimos of
but we have artificial light, we are not exposed anymore to the
exactly,
nature.
Exactly. But sure, we have communication, we have artificial light, and yet there is psychologically a very big impact of not having the sun in the sky. This is a fundamental indicator for people, and it doesn't matter how much we have contact with the internet or what have you, it is still a very important issue, clearly, for our physiology.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact upon, you know, psychology, on depression, these kind of things is there. It's clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So.
No, I will record that also.
Yeah.
Because this point of, if the clock is something only evolution can change,
mm-hmm.
In case of the fish, the evolution has had time of 1 million or several million of years, and the generation of fish is faster than the generation of humans.
Yes, yes.
Procreation is a faster process.
Yes.
So we can consider our clock as stable, as given.
Yes.
From the biological point of view, because
absolutely.
Evolution is not happening in the time scale.
Absolutely. And mm. we've our technology and our society is changing at a phenomenal rate when one compares the time it takes for our bodies to adapt. And therefore there is an increasing reliance upon medicine to provide answers to these problems that our bodies face. So I think the many of the problems that we now face are difficult to resolve. So we have a society which expects many of us to work at times of day when we normally should be in bed and asleep, and to do this on an erratic basis. And there are clear health problems that are generated by this kind of activity. Clocks control pretty much every aspect of our biology. And when we disrupt clocks, there is an inevitable disruption of many parts of our normal
mm-hmm.
Body function.
Which parts, for example?
Well, for example, I mean, our immune system
mm-hmm.
is very much controlled by the clock. So this explains, just to give you an anecdotal piece of information, when you have flu, you tend to feel a lot worse at certain times of day and better at other times of day. This is simply because your whole immune system function is changing based on your own clock activity. As a consequence, if you disrupt your clock, so if you try and work at night like night shift workers tend to do, or if you change your working schedule frequently from week to week,
mm-hmm. shift workers also are forced to do.
Absolutely.
They don't have much choice.
No, mm-hmm. no. You find that the ability, your susceptibility to illness is increasing. You tend to get more easily colds and flu. And this is something which is clearly very tightly linked with your immune system. But it gets even more serious because there are indications that the frequency or your susceptibility to conditions such as cancer are also increasing with disruption of your clock. And therefore, the prediction here again is that the immune system probably has some role to play. I mean, the immune system is in a process of surveillance, looking for aberrant developments in your body like cancer. Well, if your immune system is impaired by as a consequence of your working activity, then there is a very logical step forward to say that possibly its ability to block conditions such as cancer are also going to be reduced. So there's a lot, I mean, there is a lot of awareness of this now, which I think in the past was not really there.
But if people have the choice, they would be good, well advised to be in tune with their internal clock.
Absolutely, of course, yeah. of course. I mean, we all like to go to sleep at a certain time of night. We should respect that. It's a real holistic issue. It's about our whole body. It's not only about our clock, but it's just generally everything that our clock is regulating. Obviously, is designed, if you want, to work in a situation where we go to bed and we get up at the time that our clocks tell us is the time to do this.